It is the 10th, right, of February. This is the licensing class. For once, we are here. Anyone else who was unaware that we've had three online classes should very much check to make sure that A, you've signed up for the class TWEN page, and B, that whatever email address that TWEN has for you is still a good one, and C, you check that account, and D, you check its spam filter, because a lot of stuff has been going out through the TWEN page, and we have at least one person who missed it all. So that is not a good thing. Okay. Any questions, thoughts, comments, things you've noticed, things that make you go, hmm? Eventually this will turn on. Do I have power? Yes. Yep. So, having finished and now knowing everything you've possibly needed to know about patents and patent licensing, we're moving on to copyright issues. And as I said before, this is not new to all of you. Perhaps it's not new to any of you, but I think it's important to discuss the basics and the framework and the differences for each of these major types of intellectual property. Okay. Thank you. I know. So, just as we looked at patents and we found the source of U.S. patent law in the Constitution, in that same sentence, we have the source of U.S. copyright law. The direction to the new Congress to make a law in order to encourage progress in the useful arts and sciences, in order to establish a system where those who chose to be creative or who had the talent to be creative would be able to exercise their creativity in a way that would provide them with some commercial benefit, and in order to receive the commercial benefit, protect them from the free riding of others on their works. The definition of what constitutes the statutory subject matter of copyright, just as we have it to a certain extent in utility patents, we have it in 17 U.S.C. 102, 17 U.S.C. being the source of U.S. copyright law in its current iteration. The copyright law is enforced by the Library of Congress, not the Patent and Trademark Office. Otherwise, it would be the Copyright Patent and Trademark Office. And that, so the website you can go to, can point your clients to, copyright.gov, very accessible, very useful, very practical. So what are the things? Literary works, kind of obvious. Musical works, including any accompanying words. So we have music and lyrics as a copyrightable work. Dramatic works, including any accompanying music. So it's not just the book, it's the book and the song and the music. As a single work. Now it doesn't mean that there aren't separate works within them. It might be a compilation. But if you think about musical theater, whether it's the Great American Musical, of which I am, in fact, a fan, or whether it's dramatic plays with music as part of them, or movies that have music underlying the film, it's a work as a whole. And the copyright law reflects that. Pantomimes and choreographic works. Now, this is where it gets kind of interesting. First of all, one would expect that the idea of a pantomime, probably somewhat of a historical artifact in the law. It's not, you know, your typical, oh, honey, what are we going out tonight? You know, we're going to go out on the town. We can see a show, listen to a concert, go to the dance, or pantomime is in town. Cool! But there it is. What makes pantomime and choreographic works interesting, of course, is the idea of having to have the work fixed in a tangible form. The idea of having to, in order to get copyright protection, it's not simply to create the work, but it's to record the work in some fashion, some tangible medium. Literary works, okay. Musical works with words, we have sheet music, we have player piano punching. Dramatic works with any accompanying music, you'll have the script, you'll have the sheet music again. Choreographic works, they had to develop a means. Unfortunately, I teach these subjects too many classes in too many similarly situated rooms. And so every once in a while, I have a memory glitch, whether I've asked a question in this class or last semester in this room. Did we talk about choreography here? Okay, good. I don't know if we did. You're humoring me. That's fine. So let's think about this. Anyone here a dancer of any sort? I don't mean going to a club. I mean more sort of formal dance. Yeah, you are. Is it a type of dance you're willing to share, talk about?
I'm a ballroom dancer.
Okay. That's very cool. So when are there specific routines that one is taught as a ballroom dancer? Okay. So ballroom dancing, per se, is more free form. But obviously, we've seen choreographed ballroom dancing. And we see other kinds of choreography. And there are famous choreographers who have created George Balanchine, right? Just Alvin Ailey, all sorts of choreographers, Jerome Robbins. And they faced a challenge. They're artists. They are artists. They are creating unique works, even if the music is the same. If you think about Swan Lake Ballet, okay, there's the music. But then there is the ballet or the Nutcracker Suite. It is the same dance or similar dance. How is it that it gets transferred from one dance company to another, from one performance to another? How is it that you could say that is George Balanchine's choreography? And how is it that Balanchine could establish a reputation? Well, they needed to come up with a way, and I don't just mean in the United States, but the idea of here's a creative work that we'd like to A, preserve, especially before we had film, and B, protect, so that the creative choreographers could also establish their monopoly, their rights to their own works. And what we have in dance and different forms of dance is essentially the equivalent of sheet music. There is a notation format to record in standardized way dance steps. Now, the sort of silly version of that, if you think about it, and probably yours as well as my exposure to this, is largely from cartoons and old sitcoms. The footprints on the floor. You may have seen this, right? That's choreography. Good choreography. But for a choreographer, someone sitting imagining a dance, they write it out the way composers write sheet music. And they can hand it to a dance captain or another choreographer or someone producing the show much later and say, okay, here are the steps. And that made it eligible for copyright protection before we could film it, before we could videotape it. The ability to take something and put it into tangible form is a prerequisite to establish protection. Pictorial, graphic, sculptural works, we have, of course, in the short reading, we do have a case about sculpture. Motion pictures and other audiovisual works. It's nice to know. Wasn't guaranteed because, of course, 1787, they sit down, they're starting to write the Constitution, they're not thinking about movies. They're not thinking about any kind of recorded anything other than books or maybe sheet music. But you couldn't record a particular performance. So it wasn't an obvious thing that motion pictures would be protected by copyright. By the way, it wasn't an obvious thing that photographs would be protected by copyright. Think about it. There's a certain leap of understanding of the craft to consider photography artistic, an art form. Photography at its base is just recording what's in front of you without any sort of addition, especially in the early days when the materials were not particularly sophisticated. And you did have people who were experimenting in different ways. But that wasn't a guarantee either. It's certainly well established now, and it has been for centuries. But every time there is a new thing, a new form of creativity that isn't an invention, the question comes, is this something separate? Then you have sort of the question of what if you take a photograph of a painting? There's an answer to that, but it's sort of an interesting meta question. Audiovisual works, sound recordings, something else that wasn't obvious. Not only wasn't it obvious, it took an awfully long time. Audio recordings were not separately protected for decades after the technology was created. Was available. What was protected was the thing that was recorded. If you recorded a song, the composer had the rights, not the performer. Even though very early on, the performer added something. Less so. I don't want to insult any of the instrumentalists here, but less so with instrumentalists playing sheet music. Yes, there's always interpretation, but a singer certainly adds a gloss to a song. But it took a long time to get that as a separate right. Carved out, the song remains protected, but the performance is its own copyrighted work. Architectural works. There you could see there might be, okay, what is this? Is it a design? Well, we have design patents for that. Is it functional? Well, maybe because it serves a function, it should actually be covered by patent. But here we have architectural works as artistic works, covered by copyright. You may not duplicate a building that is still under copyright without the permission of the architect. So this is our sort of list. But even within this list, you've got categories. And I want to break apart some of these talked about choreographic works. But there are other things here. Again, technology comes, technology changes things. And if this is our list of categories as it stands, when something new arises, we have to answer the question, we as lawyers, counseling our clients, prospectively looking at legislation, is this here or does it need to be added the way that motion pictures and sound recordings were added? So let's think of a few additional categories of things that are often subject to licenses, figure out where they fit. Computer software. We don't have a separate category for computer software, which suggests, and we know, because we looked at licenses, that computer software is considered eligible subject matter for copyright. So, where would you put computer software and why? Somebody has put it somewhere. Where would you put it?
Maybe it's copyright protectable.
Yes, it is. And here are our enumerated categories of copyrightable works. Which one is computer software? Other audiovisual works. So you're saying that software is like a motion picture, because that's the implication. So when you have a spreadsheet, or you have embedded software running a centrifuge, is that an audiovisual work? There may not be a display. So I'm not sure it fits in well here. Yes, can it? We're looking at an audiovisual work that is shown to us because of software, but what do you think?
Literary works.
That's certainly one possibility. The idea that the, what do we call it? We call it writing code, authoring code. That while the output may not read like, well, it might read like certain avant-garde works of writing, but it doesn't read like your typical fiction or nonfiction work. Sometimes it doesn't read at all to human beings. It may be in machine code. Nevertheless, the process of creating and structuring computer software by humans is very similar to the process of creating literary works. It's input largely through keyboards. It is structured according to rules of grammar, of punctuation. So yeah, it may well fit into the literary works category. Is that an obvious thing, though? Today, if any of you has, yeah, you were gonna say? I mean, today is programming, maybe. But what about punch card programs? The earliest computer programs for the earliest computers were not flowing lines of words and symbols. They were sometimes literally holes in paper cards. And you put a hole here, and then you put a hole here in the next card, put a hole here in the next card, you stack them up and you pray you didn't screw up and that they didn't get folded or spindled or mutilated. That's where that comes from. Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. If you've ever heard that phrase, computer punch cards. And they would go into a card reader and one at a time it would figure out which holes were punched. And that's how the code was input. The changeover was, by the way, a very, very fast changeover. My sister is 2.5 years older than I. So she was born in the early Stone Age. When she went to, she graduated high school in 1982. And when she took computers in high school, and even in her first year, I think, at Binghamton, she was using punch cards. By the time I was taking computer programming just a couple of years later, they were teaching us on terminals. You know, so I missed, thank God, I missed the punch card thing. But the methodology wasn't always as closely akin to literary works, to writing. But yeah, we can also see that if you consider computer programs by what they do, they might fit into some other. It could be an audiovisual work. Yeah. It could be graphics. It could be an audiovisual work or a sound recording. Ultimately, sound recordings that are digitized are put into code that drives computer chips to make the sound. That's how it happens. But for the sake of understanding, the general framework has developed that, yes, computer programs are literary works. But there was another real serious problem with protecting software. And that had to do with the requirement that for copyright protection, the work be affixed in tangible form. Computer programs don't always get put onto paper. In fact, they frequently don't get put onto paper or even on a disk of some kind, hard, soft, floppy, magnetic. Sometimes computer programs exist in chips. So do other kinds of files. But software may exist only in a memory chip. And sometimes that chip is only that, it's only in memory as long as there's power. The courts have had to wrestle with the question, is software protectable if it only exists in memory? If it never gets printed out or affixed to a disk? And the answer the courts have come to is yes. Yes, it is protectable. That its existence on that chip is sufficient to be affixed in a tangible medium. Right? You don't have to feel it, but you have to be able to feel the thing that it's that's holding it. And even if it only exists for a short amount of time, it's not permanently affixed, that ephemeral existence is enough. So this is a settled question. Still kind of back and forth is whether software is protectable by patent. It may be, it may not be, depends on which week we're talking about. But copyright, fairly clear-cut, protected as the equivalent of a literary work, no matter in what format that software is created or saved or run. Good? Good. So we have all these different copyrightable works. And if we come up with some new medium, holography, telepathic broadcasts, knows what, smell-o-vision, whatever it's going to be, there will have to be some either fitting into an existing category or adding a new one if it fits the same framework. Here's the really, really, really important differentiator between copyright and any other major intellectual property structure. And copyright exists. To say something is copyrightable essentially is the same as saying it is copyright protected. We don't have a requirement for registration. If you are, and you're hopefully not, sitting at your desks, writing short stories instead of taking notes. For that matter, well, the notes, we're going to set aside for a second notes and what their copyright status is. But if you were writing a short story, it can be a very, very short story. But if in fact it is original to you, the moment you finish it, it is legally protected under the federal copyright laws. No further action required for its protection to be valid. Doesn't have to be very long, doesn't have to be particularly good. Copyright happens upon the creation of the work. No filings necessary, no labeling's necessary. We do file, though, our clients do, or we do on their behalf. We do label things, and that is because sometimes people infringe copyrights. And the way to enforce your copyright, or your client's copyright, is in a federal court. And the court will only take jurisdiction, will only take the case, allow you to enforce a copyright if that copyrighted work is on file with the Copyright Office. So you don't have to file it a registration. It's not an approval. There is no evaluation process. There's no examiner. There's no office actions. You file, it gets recorded. And once you've got a filing, a registration, you may bring an action. Why do we advise our clients to file before they're enforcing? Why, as a matter of practice, do newspapers and movie companies and other companies that are in the practice of creating ongoing copyrightable works, why do they bother filing? It's a modest fee, but it's not a $0 cost. Why is that? It does put the world on notice, as does putting a little C in the circle and a year and a name. So what?
I think it builds a stronger case for when you bring an infringement action.
Not quite. It's not a question whether the case is strong, because remember, the copyright exists. If you could demonstrate that it is that they've had access, or it is substantially similar, or you could say, yes, they have it, and then they duplicated it or did something to it. So it's not a question of the strength of the case. Why then?
It's much easier to prove the date.
Yes and no. That is helpful, but there are other ways of establishing time frames. That's not why. Why?
I think if the litigation is successful, then the holder copyrights entitled to statutory damages and attorney's fees and all.
Yep, because you get more money that way. Because they're put on notice. Because infringers, in the same way that our clients label inventions as patent pending once the application goes in, because that enhances their ability to collect damages after the fact, not only does their protection go back, but if they have put people on notice that there might be protection coming one of these days, dating back to the filing, and they infringe that patent once it's issued, the extent of available damages is higher. So too with copyright. The idea being that because something is filed, is registered, is available to the public is put on notice. Anyone who then goes ahead and infringes is at the very least negligent. And at worst, intentional. Because they could have found out. And so that's why we file, not only because it gives our clients access to the courts, but because it lets our clients collect more when they win. Copyright is forever in the existential sense. Because it lasts beyond our lives. So once we die, right? The rest of eternity, from our perspective, unless you're looking down from above, in which case you've got 70 years of looking down from above, watching people infringe or not your copyright. Life of the owner, of the creator, for an individual creator, plus 75 years. And for a corporate, it's 70 plus 70, is it 75 years for corporations? Oh, for anonymous. 95 years from publication or 120 years from creation. So, a long time. And not only is it a long time, it is a time that has extended over time. It didn't used to be this way. Why is it that copyright lasts so long now and it didn't? Considering this is a monopoly, we don't like monopolies in the law. Patent's only 20 years. Why is copyright? Well, first of all, why is copyright allowed to be longer than patent? Why is the monopoly of a copyright less troublesome, it seems, than the monopoly of a patent? What do you think? What do you think? So if it's not as important, so go with that. If that's the case, it's not as important, so what? Well, how does that translate to time frame in your mind?
So then maybe they don't care if you have a monopoly over that copyright work for so long.
That's certainly a possibility. Although, considering the kind of money that arises out of copyrights, you know, versus your typical invention. Yeah, some pharmaceuticals, some inventions do well, but who's making the hundreds of millions of dollars? It's the people creating the copyrighted works. And a single copyrighted work may have a significantly broader impact than a single patented work on society, on all sorts of things. I think it's more the nature of what the protection is. What is the monopoly? What's covered? We talked about patents. What does a patent cover? What kinds of things does the patent prohibit others from doing? What kind of inventions? Yes, well, no, it doesn't prevent people from doing useful inventions. But you have a patent. Which things are covered by the patent? Just identical copies of the invention?
Machines, processes, that specific machine that's actually created in that way. Right?
No. Exactly no. What's covered by a patent?
The
ideas. It's not the ideas. Somebody, I heard somebody say it. It's what's claimed. Right, but let's start with what is claimed. We talked, if you recall, at one of our not really in real place classes about the balance, but how you draft a claim. I think it was Mary who suggested that you draft as broadly as possible. Maybe it was Antonio. I don't remember who was. But then there was the, I'm sorry, Antonio. But then there was the question of broadly versus narrowly, that if you go too broad, you won't get the protection. If you go too narrow, it won't be good protection. Because remember, a patent may be infringed by someone else who has never seen or heard of or who does not know about the invention. And what is the other person's invention may look nothing like the patented invention, may sound nothing like it, may be for a totally different purpose, but if the description in the claims of the first work, the invention, the patent, also includes a description of the second thing, the second thing is prohibited from being made or sold or licensed or anything else. Yeah. There's certainly an argument, isn't there? One of the arguments against patents at all, and one of the arguments against expanding patents, is that patents hurt creativity. Exactly right, because they can be read so broadly, even when they are narrowly crafted, because they cover things, it's not just copying, it's not just duplication, it's not just use. It could be a totally independently developed, separate innovation that the first creator gets to prevent from coming to market. And the first creator doesn't have to have brought it to market. We have situation upon situation where very successful second new company is squashed, or at least someone attempts to squash it using a patent. And sometimes it's non-practicing patent holders, aka trolls. Sometimes it's not. My favorite example of this, because it had a real impact on my life, was the palm computing graffiti method of inputting characters. And those of you who are in my externship class, you'll either have seen this or will be seeing it, because, as I say, Perth had a personal impact on my life. But the reason that that Palm Computing succeeded in its handheld PDAs, its personal digital assistant, not public display of affection, and Apple didn't, and Casio didn't, and all the others, was because, unlike all the others, Palm allowed you to accurately handwrite. This was 1996. I realize this is ancient history for most of you, but ask your parents, ask the older people you know about the Palm Pilot. And people who would never have had an electronic thing had a Palm Pilot. And how was it? Because they could actually write on the damn thing, and it would work, as opposed to the Apple Newton, which was very cool. I never had one. I'm not sure I knew anybody who had one. It was very cool. It was a much more powerful computing device, but you would write your name on it, and it would say egg freckles. That's a classic Doonesbury. Doonesbury was singularly responsible for destroying the market for the Newton by savaging its failures in handwriting recognition. And Apple, in turn, buried in later versions of the Newton an Easter egg where if you wrote egg freckles on the screen, it would pop up a panel from Doonesbury. So, but Palm got it right. And the way Palm got it right was they figured out that rather than the computer figuring out what your handwriting was, you would use a special, simple version of handwritten stuff that it could understand, that every character would be a single stroke. You'd never lift your pen. When you lifted your pen, you were going on to the next character. And so any character that would ordinarily be made with, can I even do this? Do I have my thing? I don't know. I do. Maybe I can do this. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's called graffiti. Okay, so this is sort of what it looks like. Pop. Very simple. Very simple, let's see. Top. Okay. A. B. C. D. You may ask why I'm still so good at this. Because I still use it. But anyway. No. That's Y. X is like that. Y and so Z. Very simple. If you want a capital letter, and then the letter. Numbers were very much this, I realize this is W X Y. Not hard. Not hard at all to learn. Huge success. Actually, the first way they did it was they put it on the Newton. Replacing the egg freckles. Big success. Oh, we can make our own devices. Palm Pilots became Trios. You know, they actually mattered. And then came Xerox. Now, Xerox is not really known for personal digital assistants. Xerox is known for inventing things that other people make a lot of money with, like the Macintosh. All the sort of graphics and the mouse and everything else came out of Xerox. You know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak very famously took a tour of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Ooh, those are really cool computers, guys. Then came the Mac and Lisa. But anyway, so here was Palm doing its thing with this graffiti, and somebody thinks about it at Xerox. He said, don't we have a patent on unistroke characters? Don't we have a patent on entering text in a computer with single strokes? Let's go through the drawer. Ooh, look, we do. They sued Palm. And 11 years and $22 million later, Palm finally settled. Along the way, it had to replace its own invention with somebody else's two-stroke characters. It was a whole thing. The reason I still know this is because you think about the rights and licenses and everything else. Three or four corporate reorganizations later, the rights now permitted, because they settled with graffiti, with Xerox. So the rights to this now live in a company called Access in Japan. And among the things that Access has done with the rights to graffiti, it has created a version of graffiti for Android. So that's how I enter text into my Android devices, because it's a lot faster for me and a lot less distracting than having to tap like this. But the point of the exercise, why I go off on a tangent with this, it isn't. It highlights this issue. Because the people at Palm, they didn't do the tour of Xerox like Wozniak and Jobs did. They didn't say, ooh, unistroke characters, Xerox people, that sounds like a great idea. They sat down and created it themselves. And they were successful at it. And then they were slammed with a patent infringement suit that ultimately had merit, because this thing that they had invented, someone else had also invented, was a different character set. Totally different use. But the claims of one described the other. Yeah. Welcome to patents. You don't like it. Well, you would if you were Xerox.
They were unnoticed. Yeah. They were unnoticed that patent existed to single stroke, characters.
Well, the problem is, and my patent people, in theory, they were unnoticed. But again, how do you search? You pay a lot of money, but if you don't come up with the right words, if they don't use the same terminology, it's not nearly so easy. So yes, in theory, they were on notice. In reality, they just came up with this thing, and in their category, nobody else in the marketplace was doing it. And they were three people, or two or three people, in the metaphorical or perhaps actual garage at the time. And they didn't know they were building their whole business on it. And ultimately, they managed to do other things and succeed and then fail and then get bought by HP and then get destroyed, and made me very sad. But in the meanwhile, this was an innovation. So, yeah.
I was counter-argued and said that patents actually promote creativity.
Well, they do, in the same way that because Constitution. That's why they're there. Because people want to be paid for their creativity rather than having to go dig ditches. Or it forces, or companies, instead of choosing to innovate that way, use their patents as rather blunt instruments to try to get their competitors out of the marketplace, i.e. Apple and Samsung, and Google, and LG, and everybody except Palm HP, because ultimately they had the patents on the smartphone, and even if they were a smaller player, nobody wanted to sue them. When Palm came out with WebOS and the first Palm Pre, there were sort of vague thoughts that Apple was going to sue them for patent infringement. Never happened, and people realized why. Because when you hold the patent for the smartphone, you've got a whole lot of counterclaims there. And so everyone was like, don't hurt us. And then we were sort of left to do and fail, and maybe that was the better decision. But is Apple innovating by trying to keep Samsung off the market? Is Samsung innovating by trying to keep Apple off the market? That's the monopolies are bad argument. Use your monopoly to be anti-competitive, to reduce choice for consumers. You're right, there are absolutely legitimate arguments about the need for protection, the need, and it's driving people to innovate further. But sometimes that innovation is not new thing, it's how do we invent around? Yeah.
So would that be just like Google and Yahoo? The search engines, the actual search engines, would that be copyright or would that be patent?
Good question. I'll turn it back to you.
I'll assume patent?
Well, it could be either or both. Now, it's only patent if, at the time, first of all, it's only patent if Google, whichever came first, was sufficiently innovative and in a way that was, now if it's an algorithm, it's not protectable under patent law. So maybe neither one could get patent. And then you have to look to the code. So one of the reasons why copyrighted works have longer protection is the scope of that protection is much less. You don't have claims of a copyright. You have a work. And from a point of view of copying, as opposed to retransmitting or broadcasting or doing one of the other exclusive things, from the point of view of coming up with something else that is an infringement on the first thing, the standards are much higher. You can, in theory, from the two different sets of infinite numbers of monkeys, come up with two identical novels, word for word identical. And if each was created completely and demonstrably independent of the other, both are validly protected by copyright. Doesn't matter which came first or which came second. If the second one can show, I have been on this island in this cave with no media of any kind typing away for the last 20 years on this wonderful new book, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Oh, but it's you may not make any traction in the market, but it's copyrightable. If you can't show actual copying, the second standard is there is a substantial similarity and you could show access. The second person had access to the first, and the work that was created is substantially similar. But beyond that, lots of creativity. So there is less of a need to limit the time from the point of view of the market, because copyright focuses on not an idea, but the expression of the idea. So other expressions of the same idea can coexist. And ultimately, yeah, there's something to, they may have big impacts on the economy, but they're rarely copyrightable works that are saving lives. But that explains why it can be longer. Why it is this long, though, and why it keeps getting getting longer, that's market-driven. How long was the lifespan of a copyrighted work in 1790? First of all, it was probably limited somewhat by geography. Second of all, you know, books didn't stay in print forever. It just, you didn't have that type of marketplace. Think about today. Think about, well, heck, go to Netflix or Amazon Prime or and look to see how far back their collections go. There are silent films available from those services, films that were made 90 or 100 years ago. D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, 1914, I think, or 16. It's 100 years old. Colossally, colossally influential film for a whole host of both good and not so good reasons. Still commercial value. We have media that survive a long time. We have companies, copyright creating businesses that survive a long time. Why do we have life of the creator plus 70 years? Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse. The Walt Disney Company has been one of the biggest players in pushing the extension of copyright laws. Why? Mickey Mouse. Because they have a character, not just a character. They have films that were made, Snow White came out, what, 39? Something, or 37? Around then. Okay, Steamboat Willie, 1927-ish, 28. Am I wrong on that? You have these animated films that came out 70 years ago that are still selling. There's still value there. And if they hadn't extended these copyrights, anyone could sell copies legally of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs by Walt Disney, or Fantasia, or any of those other early films, or Gone with the Wind. The Wizard of Oz, which has gone, had all sorts of issues. It's a Wonderful Life is another one where everyone was showing it, and then TBS, basically, Turner, took it back because of these extensions of copyright. Now, there are some sort of oddities in that. The market forces, the market powers, are driving the extension of copyright law. In fact, we are unique in this. The United States is way on the outside in terms of the length of copyright protection. And what I've heard is that some of the, I don't know whether it was the Trans-Pacific Treaty or the European Treaty, there are two transnational trade treaties being negotiated now in somewhat secrecy. And there's real concern about which country's laws are going to be extended to the other countries as part of the negotiation. And there is some significant concern from companies whose copyright laws are less long, not that they don't exist, that the U.S. is going to impose its, as part of the negotiation, require those companies to extend copyright protection. So there's some of this is market-driven length. Interesting, though, is that while yes, if something is created today or since these changes have gone into effect, that copyright life of the creator plus 70 years. And to a certain extent, that has benefited previous works, but there is a huge difference between what's the case today and what was previously. That in today's laws, you don't have to file. That wasn't true decades ago. And so a lot of otherwise still valuable works are now in the public domain. Public domain means very simply, no one holds the copyright, or everyone holds the copyright. And if you go and see these collections in National Wholesale Liquidators or whatever of these $2 DVDs of all these classic movies, public domain. The Superman animated cartoons by the Fleischers, phenomenal works. Anybody can show them, anybody can sell copies of them, because the Fleischer studio did, or National Periodicals, whomever, didn't properly maintain the copyrights. They passed it into the public domain. Once they're in the public domain, they don't come out again. So there is this balance that not everything that's that old remains protected, but some things remain protected, and the companies that created them are holding on to that protection for dear economic life. And that drives licensing, because in the absence of public domain, the only way to get access to those works is with the permission of the work of the owner through a license. So public domain is one thing. Public domain is a status. No copyright protection. But we also have things that are available, sometimes even permissibly available, that are fully protected by copyright. And there's a lot of misunderstanding, these myths of copyright. And one really important one, and one that is crucially about licenses, is something called open source. Now, I include with that freeware. It is not my observation. I'm neglecting at the moment, I'm forgetting at the moment, who came up with this formulation, one of the great thinkers of modern tech IP. And I apologize right now, blanking on it. But English is a problematic language for describing rights. Because what does free mean? The simplistic version of it is, do you mean free as in speech or free as in beer? Is it free of restriction or free of cost? Two very different, maybe both, maybe neither. But of the two, depending on your mood, you may prefer free speech or free beer. Freeware often refers to the cost of zero. But just because someone isn't charging doesn't mean it isn't owned. That is a choice of the license holder, of the copyright holder, excuse me, whether or not to charge others for access to the work. So free of cost, the fancy way to put it is either gratuit or libre. Gratuit meaning free of cost, and libre meaning free of restriction. But in English, it's just free. Now, let's contrast that with open source. Anybody know, can share what open source means? Anyone familiar with the concept or the terminology of open source? Go ahead.
Generally, I think it's you provide some source code, some basic background coding language, and allow an invitation or community of coding people to add to it, modify it, correct it, use it freely as they see fit.
Not exactly. And it's an important not exactly, but thank you for starting us on the discussion. Okay, quick definitions. We talked about software, and this largely comes up in software, although the concepts are being extended to things like music. But it started in software. The human-typed, human-readable version of software is called source code. That gets compiled, turned into ones and zeros and computer commands, and that's called object code. And most normal people, unless they're Sheldon Cooper, cannot read object code. They read source code. Most of the time, if you buy, that's air quotes for the recording, buy software for your computer from Microsoft or whatever, You don't get the source code. You get the object code. You're not allowed to see the source code because once you see it, you can know how it works, make changes to it and the like, and they don't want that. That's a business decision. And they, as the copyright holder, have the right not to license to you that version, not to provide it to you. But there's an entire philosophical movement within software that says, we don't want our code to be closed off. We want others potentially to have access to it, either to make changes to it or to know how we're doing what we do. And so we are going to open up the source code. We're going to provide this as an open source license. Now the reason where the beginning answer was a not exactly is because of the other common licensing terms. Open source can refer to the choice of the developer to release the source code like the hounds and let people see it. But it also can be an obligation that comes with the license agreement. Many open source licenses require that anything that incorporates this open source stuff into it must then also be released as open source. Generally, with open source software, if the user asks for the source code, you're required to provide it. So, but let's step back. Anything that includes the open source code must itself be released as open source. This is a huge problem. Huge. Because companies don't necessarily know when their employees are putting open source things into their products. If Microsoft wants to keep its source code proprietary, but one of its developers, in response to a particularly difficult thing to do in Microsoft Word version 2017, whatever, says, you know, there's an open source software library I know about that solves this very problem. And they're sharing it with the world. And they don't charge anything for it. You may even use it for commercial purposes. I'm going to go take that open source software and build it into Microsoft Word 2017. And suddenly, Microsoft Word 2017 must legally be released as open source software. The license either affects or infects, depending on your perspective, the rest of the product. It's not just software. It can be hardware. Many of you are familiar with the ubiquitous Linksys routers. They used to be blue. I don't know what color they are now because Cisco bought Linksys, but for a long time they were the blue ones, the wireless access points and routers. And Linksys did not generally release, there's software running in those things. You don't put a disk in, but there's software that allows it to do what it does and allows you to configure it, et cetera. And it was closed source, or so Linksys thought. But then somebody realized that what those boxes were running on was an adapted version of the open source Linux operating system. Linux is an operating system for computers that works like closed versions called Unix, but it was completely created from scratch without access to the Unix code by Linus Torvalds and a whole bunch of other people, and it is released out there open source. But the Linux license, like so many of these others, requires anyone incorporating Linux into their products to release those products as open source. And when people figured out that Linksys had included Linux, I know they sound alike, they're not spelled alike, in its routers, they made a demand, and Linksys was forced, because it had two choices. Either recall all of those routers and replace their operating systems with something else, or release the code. And Linksys released the code. in a way that computer developers, software developers could look at and understand and modify and replace. And so now, routers that are based on open source Linux can have their entire operating systems replaced because they've given, releasing the code gives people enough understanding of how they work so they can swap something in. And if you have a Linksys router and there's some other brands, you don't like the way it works, it's not powerful enough, you can't secure it well enough, you could download totally new, they call it firmware. You've heard that phrase, it's not hardware, it's not software, it's firmware, like tofu. It means software that's embedded. And you can replace the software in your Linksys router with something called DDWRT, and there are some others, and you could totally change it. You could make it triply powerful. It's a nice thing. It's actually very cool. But the reason that's possible is because they had to release the code. Many of you, like I, carry Android phones. And Android phones are running on an open source operating system from Google that various companies take and they customize. They put their own little faces on them, but they have to release, because it's open source, they have to release the source code. And people say, oh, good, now we can further modify it. We can figure out how to root, to change the code to give more access to users. Even Apple phones, OS X, both versions, are based on some open source technologies. Not completely, but some, and that's largely how people get access. Yeah.
So after Linksys had to release open source, could they have included in their product, if you do modify it, then there's no warranty?
That's a different issue, and maybe they could. Yes, because that's a contract term. That's their obligation whether or not to provide service to you, but it has nothing to do with their ability to restrict you. And that was not intentional. And as we counsel our clients, and I've had this conversation numerous times with clients, especially those who are hiring outside software developers from various countries around the world, or even in the United States. Do you intend what they're developing for you to be proprietary, to be closed? Yes, yes, yes. Well, then you'd better, A, make sure that they know, B, tell them, and make them sign an agreement saying they're not going to include any open source stuff in here because it will change your whole legal obligation, and C, dear client, be aware that you may end up with it anyway. And because they may just screw up. And you need to understand the risk issues of that. That is a licensing issue. So some of the exclusive rights granted by copyright, reproduction, derivative works. I want to come back to derivative works on Wednesday, because that is a very broad subject of the spread of copyright protection from the original to the things that derive from it, and how broad that gets, and all the ways that turns into a copyright license. Distributing copies, all sorts of ways, public display, public performance or digital transmission of sound recordings, including for hold music. All right, we're gonna stop here. Yeah. Meaning if it's not a human being, companies and things like that. And I need to check those numbers. But companies have different rights. So if it's corporate copyright, et cetera. So let's, we're gonna move on to work made for hire, which will lead us into the discussion of the few cases and some other issues. Hopefully here, but either way, Wednesday night.